masses are being redirected. We are living in an artificially induced state of consciousness that resembles sleep.
All right, everybody. This is Dissonance. Say it again, Sam. Say it again. Is this thing on? Sorry, man.
Oh, Don.
Oh, Don.
Don.
Welcome to Precognitive Dissonance. This is the live show we do every Thursday night here on Anomaly Radio with my co-host...
In Austin, Texas.
Craig York.
And my friend and co-host, Miles Lewis.
Thank you. It's good to be here. You know, it's always good to be here. And I want to give an update on whether we're going to be here much longer. And last night's show, or wait, no, two nights ago when I was doing a show with Mac, we were harping on the ongoing
internet, upcoming legislation.
Yeah, the saga of the Copyright Royalty Board and all that crap. You know, basically the deadline for payments on that is July 15th, which is this Sunday. And everybody around the world and broadcaster and listener alike has been waiting to hear what's going to happen that day. Is everything going to explode? Is the RIAA and Sound Exchange and all those wonderful, wonderful music industry people going to start serving papers on every little small webcaster and every big webcaster and directory and streaming service like Live365.com? If you don't know what I'm talking about, go to live365.com/choice, and you can find out all the latest on this issue, which basically involves how the music industry wants to bill small and large webcasters alike on a per-person, per-song basis, far in excess of anything anybody else, whether it be satellite or terrestrial radio, have to pay. And while the Internet certainly facilitates the ease of tracking how many and to what they're listening, which could be a boon for the artist, we would hope, but meanwhile, that's kind of getting all complicated, and just check into it, and please, if you're moved by it, please contact your legislators, and again, that's live365.com/choice or savenetradio.org.
Keep us on the air, folks. Exercise your franchise, damn it.
And you can always listen to past episodes of Precognitive Dissonance at that same name,
precognitivedissonance.com,
and podomatic.blahblahblahblah.com.
It's a really lovely website.
It's a nice little template. I like the misty bridge image at the top, which to me kind of
bridge to the unknown.
Yeah, it's misty. You can't quite see that far. You're not sure. It's kind of spooky and paranormal, but almost dreamlike.
Kind of like an image composed by M. Night Shyamalan.
I think he uses that kind of urgent sense presence of fog in a lot of his films.
Yeah. There's nothing wrong with that.
Well, last time we ended the show really abruptly, and we were...
Well, we had been talking about an awful lot of things, and not quite get... And you, bless your heart and damn your eyes, have pulled out a whole host of texts that I would have borrowed from you and prepared a little bit better. As it is, we've got... I wanted to talk about... alternative archaeology and archaeological anomalies. And one of my favorite sources for that is Science Frontiers Online, which we talked about the newsletters, which go back to 77. One of the ones that comes to me off the top of my head is a tracing of a series of canals in central Florida, along with some enormous shell middens. That have shown up there. Shell middens are basically piles of seashells, edible clams and whatnot that the indigenous culture was supposed to have created, but these things are huge. They're acres in extent and meters deep.
Science-frontiers.com is the website for Science Frontiers Online, and this is the premier resource for just straightforward anomaly. William Corliss, whom we've got to get on the show, is basically the modern Charles Fort, but from what I gather, less the fanciful writer and more just the hardcore informationalist, to use the phrase I like to call myself.
He offers the reports with very little in the way of interpretation or sensation, but they are all the more wonderful for all that. We're looking at one 1989 sightings of Ogopogo, the Western Canada lake monster of Lake Okanagan.
Is that just a trail of sea otters?
It could be.
Are those pelicans? I can't tell. One of the other things I love about
No, Mr. Arnold, those are not pelicans.
That's
no moon.
We've got Blue Moon on tap tonight, folks. Thank you very much, Craig.
I have a nice coffee myself. But.
One of the things I love about all of the works that William Corliss has put out over the years is the illustrations. They're not real fancy. They're very just like somebody who's doing science drawings just wants to basically, you know, capture the essence and the basics of the information so that at a glance folks can do that. So it's basically him doing that in both written and sometimes, not for every report, but visual terms. And some of the other things that he always cataloged in excess that I just was fascinated by and that thankfully folks like Ivan Sanderson also tapped into are the strange phenomena of luminescent geographic oceanographic marine phenomena, whether it be, you know, pillars of lights coming out of the tips of mountains or somewhat auroral-like discharges over certain sites, or the fluorescent pinwheels in the ocean sighted by navies for eons,
and one that will be familiar to a lot more people, the green flash at sunset.
And I always flash back to all those green flash back to all those pictures and of the, you know, the fingers of light, reports of St. Elmo's fire and other BOL, ball of light phenomena, and projections of light from the tips of fingers of some strange individuals.
www.science-frontiers.com. Check it out. The newsletters are archived back to 1977. There's about a dozen per year, and it's quite a lot to read.
Well, the books that you had brought with you that you'd borrowed last time and returned last time, during our last episode,
are by a friend of yours,
and I'm really glad to be able to call this guy a friend. I mean, we don't correspond that often, but it's been my pleasure to interact with him a number of times over the years, and that is Paul Devereaux. Paul Devereaux is one of those Renaissance men, stodgy old Brits, but he's, you know, not afraid to go out in the wilderness, though like any good Brit, he hates the Texas heat. And even the Texans
like,
do, too.
Like any sentient biped, Miles.
But I guess I first became aware of Paul Devereaux because he was offered by the mainstream media as an alternative skeptic of the UFO, the classic alien spacecraft interpretation of UFOs. Mm-hmm. And his main claim to fame among UFO researchers is the Earthlights book and Earthlights Revelation, his two books on the subject of mysterious luminous phenomena.
Subtitled UFOs and Mystery Light Form Phenomena, the Earth's Secret Energy Force. Devereaux's basic brief, as I understand it, I haven't actually read Earthlights Revelation, but the basic notion is that electrical energy, ball lightning or plasma, tends to accumulate on along fault lines, and that these are frequently the source that and other forms of seismic disturbance are frequently the origin of a lot of UFO reports. Obviously, it's a notion that's gotten a fair amount of coverage and seems to cover a lot of aspects.
Well, you know, arch nemesis of ufology, Phil Klass, was well known for his quite debunked but still relatively sane idea that you know, UFOs represent some kind of plasma phenomena, that they were balls of plasma energy, you know, that is operating. I can't give a really detailed description of plasma, but it's a highly charged.
It's the fourth state of matter, highly ionized, gaseous matter, highly energized.
And it's something that we now use in all kinds of welding and cutting technologies and a variety of other high-tech uses.
We're talking to you tonight through the benefit of one of the most important modern manufacturing techniques. I've seen plasma chambers that create the silicone wafers that eventually become the chips in our computers. Some of the earlier ones are very H.G. Wellsian devices. They look like a giant pot with these portholes set in them. And when they're turned on, when the plasma is baking the silicone into the wafer, there is this orange glow in the chamber that seems everywhere and nowhere.
I recall in the last 2 years there was a short animation circling the web. I posted it on one of my UFO sites, either newfoc.com or ufouniversity.com, and it was basically reproducing ball lightning in a microwave. And it was a real simple technique, but it conjures this image of roiling energy. But so Devereaux, and actually you mentioned Devereaux's idea about the fault lines and UFOs, and that's probably correct. It's been a while since I read that, but it's in fact Michael Persinger, the Laurentian University neuroscientist. Actually, he may not. Forget if he's a neuroscientist. Yeah, he's a neuroscientist, not an electrical engineer. That's what it is.
Hmm.
He's the one who came up with the skeptical book, Space-Time Transients and Unusual Events, where he correlated not just UFO events but other strange Fortean phenomena like sightings of anomalously large pterodactyl birds or strange archaeological finds. And you know, his main idea was that the stresses along fault lines, the mini quakes that go on a regular basis, could generate this kind of luminous phenomenon. And again, earthquake lights are not unknown, and Japan and other countries where they've dealt with volcanoes for a long, long time are quite familiar with luminous lights that are associated with the landscape. And that's where this really Devereaux's brilliance comes in, because he's really like a modern-day shaman explorer in that he's focused on these phenomenon and their interaction with human consciousness, especially ancient cultures who, as the golden age romanticized vision we all have of the aboriginal who is in touch with nature. But I think in a lot of ways that's really was true and could be true again. And he's explored ancient sacred sites and megalithic sites and quote-unquote Earth's mysteries and ancient mysteries under these areas.
The one book that I did read was Mysterious Ancient America, which I want to get back to in a minute, but I did some digging this afternoon because there was something I wanted to see how the work was regarded today, and that was the work of Barry Fell, who at one time was something of a known name in the notion of especially what's called pre-Columbian contacts with the Americas. Fell documented ostensibly a number of samples of Celtic writing, some supposed Phoenician inscriptions, and some early Roman contacts in the New World, primarily from North America. But he evidently was roundly attacked by the American archaeological community, and there seems to be a lot of divided opinion out there. There are people that find a lot of his ideas intriguing and compelling, and then there are some people that just really think you've left your brain in a jar someplace if you take him at all seriously. Having had a chance to read a little bit of the pros and cons of the argument, there's some evidence to suggest that Fell was a little bit dogmatic in his own way. He seems to have been a determined amateur. His actual field of expertise was marine biology. There are some people that credit him with tremendous gifts in language, and there are some linguistic specialists who say that he's basically showing a very, very broad... he's painting with a very broad brush in his interpretations.
And I'm trying to find some information on this fellow. Of course, Amazon, always a good place to go for...
Actually, books. Amazon and American BC was... when I looked up this afternoon, and a lot of the reviews on there are where I'm getting this information from. You brought out something that I noticed the table of contents has a reference to it, and this is a lot of what Fell was writing about himself. The title of the book is Ancient American Inscriptions, subtitled Plow Marks or History. And it's got a committee of authors, William R. McGlone, Philip M. Leonard, James L. Guthrie, Roland W. Gillespie, and James P. Whittall, Jr. And as I say, one of the early chapters is the Fell era. Epigraphy in America, Early History, the Barry Fell era. Pages 27 to 43. Part 2 is difficulties with the epigraphic case. Part 3 is valid epigraphic data. And part 4 is epigraphy today and tomorrow. And it's handsomely illustrated.
There's a lot of, here's a photo of the inscription, and since it's hard to make out here, well, and not just because it's hard to make out, but as scientific documentation, there are attempts at field sketches, and I will say some of those, I just glancing at them before the show, I was just like, man, I guess they were there and maybe they could see it better, but from this photograph I'm having a hard time with some of this stuff. But it's I've always been intrigued by the idea of human civilizations being around longer, and this idea of kind of forbidden archaeology, the idea that there is a cover-up over human origins. And as much as folks might cringe at the idea of Atlantis and Lemuria and Mu, M-U, is Mu, M-O-O. But I'm fascinated by it. And it seems like in the early thousands, a few years ago, it seemed like every week there was some new discovery or study that was pushing back the age of modern, well, ancient human habitation and civilization, all the stuff about the Sphinx possibly being so many more thousands of years old.
Due to the water erosion patterns on its flanks.
All that stuff is just fascinating, and it really did seem for a while there. Every week I was reporting on the Chaos or the Co-op news report, every Thursday evening, actually, coincidentally. Mm-hmm. I was reading about, these... alternate histories of who got here first and that sort of thing. The other resource, you mentioned that Ancient American Inscriptions book, but I was going to bring up The Ancient American, which is a magazine that I got issues of years back when I just dabbled in this for a little while. A fantastic magazine, ancientamerican.com is where you can find out more about that. Archaeology of the Americas before Columbus, and of course, for a lot of people, you know, mainstream idiots, dupeds, you know, they don't have a clue. And Columbus is often the fallacy of Columbus is being the first person here is usually, you know, that kind of okay, maybe things aren't the way I was
told. Yeah, there's a tremendous amount of archaeology to be practiced, especially in the Middle and South American cultures. I gather there was a new Incan fortress city discovered, I think, sometime within the last 10 years. Not quite as well preserved in Machu Picchu, but pretty significant site. And that's what Devereaux covers predominantly in Mysterious Ancient America. He does write a lot about the shamanistic slash religious aspects of a lot of these sites. You get the impression that psychoactive plants were very important to a lot of these cultures.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
they're pretty damn important to this culture right here.
Well, you know.
No comment.
Weltschlang. Weltschlang.
One of the other books of his is Shamanism and the Ley Lines.
Mm-hmm.
Or rather, Shamanism and the Mystery Lines. We, on a previous episode, we talked about Devereaux's cover story article for Fortean Times a few months back that dealt with the idea of ley lines in Europe and around the world, and basically his conclusion was that there's been a lot of hooey perpetrated based loosely off of his and others' research that's been completely misrepresented, but that basically there is a worldwide tradition of old straight tracks that are often associated with both death ways in terms of transporting the body of the deceased, but also spirit paths, and that there's in fact a whole neuromancy or necromancy or magical system based on it in different cultures, and that everything from feng shui in China and certain other practices of demon catchers on buildings there to, you know, spirit catchers in Native American culture to other magical systems that deal with the lines that are called ley lines in Europe. So it was a fascinating article, and shamanism.
Yeah, well, it's one of those. It's a lot easier to determine in instances where something is known about the culture. The instance of the Incans, the Mayans, and the Aztecs. But when you get further back, the old megalithic structures, you can demonstrate that they were used for astronomical purposes. But once you get past that, and there's one of the things that's always fascinated me about Stonehenge is how little in the way of artifacts have been found in association with the site. I know there's been some finds made in connection with it, but by and large, there's just not a whole lot of evidence of the people that actually built it. Yeah.
Well, did they stop digging around after a while? Like, people got so attached to it, they're like,
That I don't really know.
I mean, I've heard that you can't actually get up to it, like, for the last
years. I had heard that it's a lot more closed off than it used to be. Now, that I don't really know. It's interesting to... there are images of it online that it's like a close aerial view, and it's pulled back far enough that you can actually see where the roads are around it. And it's
I was just flashing back to Nigel Neal's Quatermass series of movies, and there's this one... one of the movies, I can't remember the title, but it's kind of like, you know, civilizations, you know, crumbling, youth culture is going crazy, so it's, you know, very much in the, in, you know, like a, oh God, the 60s are just going rampant.
Those damn kids and their rock and roll.
And anarchy and hippiedom. And something really strange starts happening with pulses of energy and obliterating people. But it's basically this, all these young hippie kids start being mindless, controlled and mind-melded and led to these ancient sacred sites where they're then zapped.
Whoa.
Gone.
That's not one I'm familiar with.
The implication was some ancient culture that had left these things behind, and that it was, you know, interacting with modern human consciousness, but particularly of a certain age bracket. Very interesting movie. I wish I could remember the title, but there's not that many Quatermass films, so you should be able to figure out which one.
Yeah.
It's not Quatermass in the Pit, a.k.a. 5 Million Years to Earth, which is another really fantastic anomaly.
Probably the best known in the U.S., too. It's,
yeah.
I think it's the only one that's actually in color. I could
it
be
may
wrong.
Be. I've watched it so many times.
It was one of the last of the 60s Quatermass films. There's another book that was right with ancient America, and that was
Stone Age Soundtracks.
Stone Age Soundtracks, which is Devereaux's exploration of the acoustic properties of ancient sites. And it's got a picture of Stonehenge on the cover, but I can remember reading of natural amphitheaters that were used as sacred sites. Miles, have you read it?
This particular book?
Yes.
There's an inscription.
don't go all maudlin on us, Miles.
No, I've not read that, but over the years I've heard many a reference to the different acoustical and instrumented research that Devereaux has done with the Dragon Project, which were a group of scientists using scientific instruments to investigate ancient megalithic sites. And I believe it, my friend Greg Bishop told me about something he'd read about that still blows my mind, and I've probably related it on this show, and that was that some researchers, it could very well have been Devereaux and the Dragon Project, had discovered that a particular dolmen, you know, one of these earthen bunkers, or you could go inside, kind of almost like a wigwam for ceremonies that I don't think it necessarily had the astronomical alignments that some of those do, where there's a long shaft and the light comes down, and that's the only illumination for certain things on the walls. But it wasn't like that, I don't think. But they discovered that if you filled the room with smoke, a la incense, and then if you intoned at a certain vibration, the smoke would take on a shape. In other words, the chamber was acoustically designed, and I believe the shape corresponded to some of the markings on the walls. The idea being that, yes, they were quite aware of how they could manipulate matter in the form of smoke through sound. And that's a pretty powerful idea, very much invoking a Dune-esque, you know, power words and technology.
The Lynch movie, anyway. I gather the whole business with the Weirding Way is not in the books.
Really?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Having never
read the books.
I've read Dune. It's been quite a while. It's one of those, I like the first book an awful lot. I tried reading the second book and just fell out of love with it about 20 pages in.
I was fascinated with the covers when I was a child. Just looked at
the sandworm is an iconic image, and yeah, the masked Fremen.
Covers worms as a child. No, never mind. Let's not go there.
Okay. But that's it. It mentions on the dust jacket. Chambered mounds in Ireland, which is something that I had heard the acoustic properties of mentioned. There are a number of megalithic sites in Ireland and England and Scotland that are basically trenched out chambers lined with stone and then capped and turned into artificial hills. They're usually described as burial mounds. I can't recall if I'm thinking that some in Europe have been found intact. Many of the ones in England and Ireland, I think, are just the empty stone. But they are frequently reputed to have very interesting acoustical properties, very powerful echoes, which, you know, you would sort of expect.
Well, I mean, all you have to, again, go to the Aboriginal cultures, and there's a lot of stuff in different sacred texts about, you know, the God singing the world into existence. What is prayer in all these monasteries? But, you know, it's often very song oriented. Hymnals, obviously, being really so. But think of
chanting is Amazonians. A form of meditative mind manipulation, if you will.
Well,
it creates a mental state.
Absolutely, and. So it's been used by different, basically Western shamanism in that sense. But I'm thinking of the ayahuasca taking Indians in South America in the Amazon, who use the yahe vine and the strange concoction of other herbs and whatnot to make this soup that they drink, and I believe that that's part of it, is you're supposed to sing these visions into reality, such that your fellow shamans and your fellow people that are going through the experience with you can see these things as well. I'm probably not...
Well, it doesn't turn me into a giant brain-eating gecko or Stacey Keach.
I'm thinking of Terrence McKenna's and the McKenna brothers, Dennis and Terrence, their explorations the same, going to the Amazon looking for ayahuasca, but instead finding the extraterrestrial mushroom.
Woot.
Yes, woot indeed. Another of the books in the pile here from culled from the Anomaly Archives. You can go find out more about that organization at anomalyarchives.org. The Hidden History of the Human Race. Now, this is the abridged version of a much, much larger work that I wish I had the larger version of this, but Major Scientific Cover-Up Exposed by Michael A. Cremo and Richard L. Thompson from the book jacket.
It's got a lot of fascinating stuff in it. There's a couple of things in there I've seen cited before. My personal favorite is the stone sphere with the three concentric rings around, not concentric, but three equatorial rings around it. That is dated to 3.6 billion years ago.
2.8 billion, yes.
2.8, okay. Well, that is 800 million years.
oh, yes. Figure 6.9, dude, on page 121, a metallic sphere from South Africa with three parallel grooves around its equator. The sphere was found in a Precambrian mineral deposit said to be 2.8 billion years old.
Point out that Precambrian is one of H.P. Lovecraft's favorite adjectives. Is it an adjective?
Don't ask me.
Over to you in the booth, Al.
Invocation of Lovecraft, it suddenly conjures back visions of Alive in Joburg.
Yes, trailer that I did get to watch this afternoon on, the most fabulous monitor I've ever seen in my life. A 37-inch 1080p, I think. It's vast. You know, it's
huge, huge tracts of land.
Big, big flat-screen monitor. It's just a marvel to behold.
I don't think I've posted that video yet, but I'm going to be posting Alive in Joburg on AnomalyTV.com. I've been meaning to do that, but you can find it if you just Google that. It's on YouTube, or actually, it's on Google Video, I think. Really neat, alienation-esque, as you said earlier, pseudo-documentary set in an alternate 1990s where these Cthulian, Mind Flayer-esque, tentacle-faced refugee aliens have landed in South Africa.
Johannesburg.
And it has all the look of V and Alien Nation and...
These enormous, mile-wide flying discs hovering over Johannesburg.
And power plants with their tentacles going down into that.
And there's the
power.
The opening is this marvelous action sequence of a presumably renegade alien in one of their power suits, which
very
is
mecha-like.
Big Battletech honking thing about 10, 12 feet tall. And he picks up a couple of large, heavy vehicles, one of which is, I believe, an armored personnel carrier. And the other one, I think, is like an ice cream truck.
Yeah.
But and then there's a couple of troopers that are out just plinking away at him with their Stargate SG-1 machine guns. Miles thinks that the human characters are computer generated.
In that scene.
I think they're live action actors. You be the judge. Alive in Joburg on YouTube. And something else I learned earlier this afternoon was that that film, the director of that film, is going to be directing the Halo movie that's coming out. Halo being a popular, extremely popular, online multiplayer game. I believe it's online multiplayer. But it's about basically science fiction ground operations against some either alien or religious human entity. I don't know much more about it than that. But it's very big budget. It's highly anticipated.
Not being a huge gamer, I really don't know that much about it. I think my stepdad showed me some trailers for either the movie or the video game, and it was pretty impressive. But a lot of video games are really, really impressive, and I'm just worried more and more every day how close they are to getting to simulating reality a little too well.
I'm looking forward to my cybernetic overlord. I just want to kick back in my coffin and have my brain drained for energy until I wither away and get dropped to the infinite gulf below.
I, for one, welcome our new insect overlords.
Amen.
Flash to Brainstorm. The guy wires up the orgasm tape and sits in his easy chair for a week on end until his body is totally dilapidated because he's basically been experiencing climax 24/7 for 7 days or some crap.
Oh, good Lord. Hidden History of the Human Race, I had a chance to page through before we started the program, and it's, you know, chock-a-block of examples of essentially archaeological anomalies. The sphere that I mentioned, I don't recall how big that is. It, for some reason, I want to say it's the size of a grapefruit. But it's one of those, one that I happened to catch my eye was a fossilized shoe sole, which the image of it is one of those, I can see that interpretation. I can also see it being a simple, I believe, what's called a concrication, which is essentially a mud flap, which is what sandals are. But yeah, but still, you know, it looks like it's got an awful lot of very interesting stuff in it, and it's definitely going to be on my checkout list from the Anomaly Archives. Help us find a home, won't you?
Over the past two centuries, researchers have found bones and artifacts showing that people like ourselves existed on Earth millions of years ago, but the scientific establishment has suppressed, ignored, or forgotten these remarkable facts. Why? Because they contradict dominant views of human origins and antiquity. Among the many things in this book, at the back is a summary of anomalous evidence related to human antiquity that's categorized and by dip period and location and where the reference is, Scientific American, whatever magazine the citation is from. And I love some of the quotes on the back of this. Of course, 40 times says, Cremo and Thompson have launched a startling attack on our whole picture of human origins and the way we have arrived at that picture. Not only is the evidence impugned, but also the scientific method of handling it. I was going to read two more here.
Please.
Physical anthropologist William Howells says, to have modern human beings appearing a great deal earlier, in fact at a time when even simple primates did not exist as possible ancestors, would be devastating not only to the accepted pattern, it would be devastating to the whole theory of evolution, which has been pretty robust up until now. But my favorite on here is, your book is pure humbug and does not deserve to be taken seriously by anyone but a fool. Richard Leakey, anthropologist, representative of the scientific establishment's viewpoint.
Oofed.
But hey, they put it on the back of the book.
Yeah, fair enough, fair enough.
Oh, you think we're crap? Thanks, we needed the endorsement.
But yeah, and it's the sort of thing that you would expect to raise eyebrows and ire. Like I said, it looks like a fascinating work, and stuff like that, as my personal favorite are the reports of anomalous giant skeletons. There are a number of reports from 19th century America that some of them actually stretch into the early 20th century. I think the last ones that I know of take place in the 20s. And there are usually from the Midwest to the West. I can remember an instance of one being found in Minnesota. Two or three from Nevada and Colorado, and I think one or two from California. But usually these are skeletons supposedly of hominids, very manlike, but anywhere from 8 to 12 feet in height. And one thing that is frequently cited, and I think appears in more than one account, is these creatures generally have double teeth. They have two rows of dentation, which is, you know, as far as I know, morphologically unique.
No kidding.
If I may be so bold. But, of course, almost invariably, the skeletons and the sites associated with them vanish into somebody's basement or are shipped off. Ivan Sanderson writes of one such a case from the Aleutians. And this actually, this would probably be the latest that I'm familiar with because it dates from the 40s when the Aleutians were invaded by the Japanese. And one of the two islands, when it was reoccupied by the Allies,
yeah, it works for me.
Allied forces. Was reported to have sections of it that were roped off, marked with signs saying no trespassing, property of Smithsonian Institution. And that on these sites, the rumor was that what had been found were giant human skulls, one or two of them. And these things were huge, two or three times the size of a normal human skull. And Miles has brought up something with an absolutely marvelous banner, Lost Continent Library, where adventure lives forever.
Forever. That's at lostcontinentlibrary.com. This is the website publication site of Walter Bosley, who's the occasional co-host of Greg Bishop's Radio Misterioso, right here on Anomaly Radio. And
listen to it.
Bosley is somebody who I want to get on this show as well.
Yes, sir.
He's former counterterrorism, or is it counterintelligence? I forget, but or maybe both. But basically, he is one of those people who worked for the government and infiltrated UFO conferences, posing as a UFO buff, and basically doing his job, looking to make sure that there weren't Russian or Chinese or you know, some other country's intelligence services using UFO interest as a cover for finding out other secrets about the military-industrial complex. Anyway, in his spare time, he loves to go on expeditions with the likes of David Hatcher Childress, And he also is fascinated with all the stories of these ancient civilizations. He's very much a promoter or supporter of the possibility that there is, in fact, another intelligent species on the planet, but more correctly, in the planet. So he's kind of into the inner Earth stuff, but from a very learned perspective. And he's, you know, like I said, traveled a lot. And he's publishing a number of books, fiction and nonfiction, mostly nonfiction at this, that are in the pulp adventure vein. And
yes, the typeface of Lost Continent Library is very evocative of the old pulps, especially the Doc Savage adventures. And the lady on the left is certainly a cutie.
Yeah, he's got quite a bevy of beauties working for his empire.
Sunken World. Stanton Coblentz. That's a name I'm familiar with. Nine new and used from $3.99. Hmm. Scroll down and take a look at some of the reviews.
A pure pulp epic, or era, a pure pulp era classic. Hunted by German U-boats in the Atlantic, experimental submarine X-111 disappears 5 years later, and an unusual man visits the Navy Department telling a strange story that at the bottom of the ocean exists a city of wonders, inhabited by people of great intelligence, and haunted by a terrible past that threatens them again. Originally a 1927 serial and reprinted from a 1948 edition, illustrated by Charles E. McCurdy.
Now, this is doubly interesting because the experimental submarine X-111 is very evocative of a British experimental submarine, the X-1, which was actually the only British submarine scrapped before World War II. It was inspired by the German U-cruisers during World War I, which were essentially submarines with a very heavy gun armament. The idea was that they would surface and use their guns on the freighters rather than torpedoes.
I think my toy submarine from years ago, it had a little turret on it. Mm-hmm. Not a turret, but it had a gun.
Yeah. These were like that, only ever so much more so. Anyway, it was a concept that almost everybody had a few people who were high enough up to be taken with the concept to experiment with it, but it never really caught on. But the X-1 is, you know, the name is very evocative. It was a very handsome vessel, and it worked well in a lot of particulars, except its engines were rather faulty, which was doubly amusing because it used German MAN diesel engines, which were actually from some of the same sort of engines that the U-boats used. But apparently they didn't work terribly well for the Brits. And
they just didn't know how to use them correctly.
The X-1 had about a 10-year career from around 1927 to 1936. I said it was in service for about 10 years, and it's damning and delighting to see the reference to this book. I'll definitely have to order a copy, because I've toyed with the idea of writing a Lovecraftian story or series based around the X-1, sort of like the old Japanese movie Atragon, but a little bit earlier.
Not familiar with that one.
Atragon? Oh, heavens. Japanese super submarine versus the resurgent Mew Empire.
Awesome.
And
I gotta say,
orange-haired empress.
Oh, that rings a bell. But I think there's a lot of multicolored hair.
Basically, this Japanese submarine commander vanishes at the end of World War II with the last Japanese super submarine, hides away like Captain Nemo on a desert island, and builds the Atragon, or the Kaitei Gunkan in the original Japanese.
Gunkan?
Gunkan.
Gunkan. Yeah, can for goons.
Undersea battleship, thank you.
What, is that a literal?
It's
actually their word for
it? Yeah.
Okay.
Kaitei Gunkan. I think that's close.
Weird.
But it flies, it's nuclear powered. It has this enormous drill bit on the front that it uses to basically plow through the mantle of the Earth.
I may have had a Hot Wheels car that was based on that, or I mean, I know there's
well
a
the drill bit on the front end is a semi-popular motif science fiction.
Total Recall to be for one, Labyrinth even.
I'm drawing a blank on both of those, although I have seen most of both of them.
Labyrinth, there's some sewer cleaners who are by hand.
Yes.
It's a very complicated drill bit and very foreboding until you see it pass and you see the little guys operating it behind the scenes. And then in, of course, Total Recall. In Total Recall, there's it's on Mars, so there's lots of mining going on, and they have the mining cars. General Major Spoonbender Stubblebine. We got off on talking submarines, so I got to mention something, a synchronicity for me, that just today I found out that one of the many hats that Stubblebine has worn and wears is that he's on the board of directors of Canadian Sub, Canadian Sub Technologies, and
General Stubblebine taught chemistry at West Point.
And
there he is, Albert N. Stubblebine III, Major General, U.S. Army, retired.
Anybody familiar with the military's parapsychology efforts and the psychic military remote viewing program, and of course I'm in the middle of reading about Stubblebine's efforts in Reading the Enemy's Mind by Paul H. Smith. He's noticed the stack of other things I wanted to maybe talk about on the show.
Von Braun at Roswell.
So to finish the Stubblebine thread, a certain parapolitical psyop analysis guy had somebody post on his website the fact that General Stubblebine, who was in the military counterintelligence and basically got the psychic remote viewing program going in the military, the Army, who also has come out for 9/11 Truth and saying that an airliner couldn't have hit the Pentagon, he and his wife, another mover and shaker from the anomalies field, specifically abduction research and ufology, Dr. Rima Labeau, they are this tour de force in the form of the Natural Solutions Foundation, which is an alternative health organization ostensibly fighting Codex Alimentarius, which is basically the globalist agenda to radically disaffect the human population from its health resources in the form of vitamins and supplements and other things that they think we shouldn't have access to. Now, apparently, Rima and General Stubblebine, according to others that have been fighting Codex Alimentarius, are fast and loose with the facts and get a lot of their stuff wrong, and so it's the allegation is that, well, maybe he's still performing a psyop, that he is part of an effort to discredit the true alternative health movement by being, shooting from the hip with the facts and getting things wrong. Now, that those kind of allegations are a little too much to go into now, but in going over his background and history, it was one of the things I came across is the fact that he's on the board of this Canadian sub-technologies company that's obviously made up of former military and civilian industry people in the marine exploration arena and obviously marine warfare arena who are trying to offer subs to the private sector, ostensibly for research and, hey, tourism, entertainment, whatever. So that's the Stubblebine sub-connection. No gun can there, I hope.
Anyway, that was just, me spinning a little bit of a daydream. Why don't we just talk about things that we'll talk about next week? You had an article here, Von Braun was at Roswell, which sounds interesting. 1947, a controversial event took place in New Mexico near the town of Roswell. This appears to be a personal reminiscence
by a former astronaut. McClellan, is that his name?
Clark C. McClellan, Horror SCO, Space Shuttle Fleet, Kennedy Space Center, Florida, 1958 to 1992.
This will be interesting to talk about because I've been quoting a lot Dr. Carol Rosen, who worked with Von Braun and who claims that Von Braun told her that aliens were just one of many counterfeit foes that would be contrived by the military-industrial complex to unite humanity and put it under greater and greater tyranny. So the idea of Von Braun somehow being connected to Roswell brings up all kinds of possibilities, especially in light of our recent cohort, Nick Redfern, talking about body snatchers in the desert.
And, you know, it's yet another wrinkle. Entirely plausible. It dovetails very nicely with something I'm listening to, which is the classic Rise and Fall of the Third Reich by William Shurer. I'm just getting into it. It's 41 sides, 11 tapes all together.
Now, this is not the commercial audio tape because it's not from that particular industry, so it may be a different side. There's different numbers of sides for the commercial market.
Well, yes, the commercial market would be probably about twice as big, about 20-some-odd tapes and 80 sides.
Something like that.
But, and like I say, it's fairly early on, but you... you are quickly brought home to just how deeply, deeply, deeply the Nazis got into the idea of telling absolute whoppers and getting away with it to manipulate people, you know, for political ends.
So, psychological warfare, that's what it's all about.
Yeah. And you know, as much as I admire Von Braun, as a scientist and engineer in many respects, he was also, you know, put it bluntly, very unscrupulous and pretty ruthless during his tenure with the Nazis in carrying out his program. To what extent he had any power to stop it is an open question. The argument that he could have fled it, again, is there. But at the same time, it's one of those, you know, I don't think he much cared one way or another. You know.
That's pretty bad.
Well, yeah.
It's
hard to say.
Besides the Paul Smith book, I'm also reading Ken Thomas's Parapolitics, Conspiracy in Contemporary America. And... we don't tend to stray into parapolitics and conspiracy on the show. I mean, obviously they always end up dovetailing. And I have to admit, I've read some articles recently that really equate Fortean research and UFO research and others as all being connected to paranoia and conspiracy theory. And in fact, Ken Thomas's book has done a good job of convincing me that about the intrinsic similarities, you know, that I'd noticed myself, but for a long time, but between, you know, New Age conferences, UFO conferences, mind control conferences, this, that, and the other. And, I guess what I didn't realize was the intimate connections between the UFO scene and the JFK assassination. And, of course, that was what Ken Thomas was going to lecture about at the National UFO Conference here in Austin in 2001 that didn't happen, and that's basically the Maury Island incident, which happened a mere few days or weeks before the Kenneth Arnold sighting on June 24th, 1947.
Which has, very early instance of supposed suppression and
the story,
deliberate destruction of evidence.
The story is much, much more interesting than I ever realized, and the interconnections are just astounding.
Yes, when you're done with it, I definitely like to give it a read myself.
But there was one particular thing. The main point of connection between JFK and the UFO scene is more in the Maury Island incident is the man named Fred Crisman. And there's just something I thought you'd really get a kick out of related to Fred Crisman and being a fan of history, science fiction, and anomaly stuff. Now, if I could only find it. But, well, it'll be too hard to find. We'll have to talk about that later. But it basically, it's Fred Crisman was in print in, like, Harper's Magazine before the flying saucer craze started being quoted about science fiction conferences or science fiction in general. He was at a conference, I think, or something like that. Anyway, so there's this interesting thread of here's a guy who's being quoted in pretty big publications on the subject of science fiction, and then within days has his own encounter connected to another's encounter, mm-hmm. and he gets tied up with Kenneth Arnold, Ray Palmer, and the military. And as you know, the military airline crash, multiple airline crashes connected to all this. And
okay, I know about the B-25, but you can tell me about the rest of them next time.
Yeah.
On Precognitive Dissonance.
Thanks for joining us, everybody. You've been listening to us via Anomaly Radio, and you can find out more about our show of Precognitive Dissonance at precognitivedissonance.com.
.com.
All right, everybody, thank you.
Everybody chant. .com.
Enough of that.
That's a mantra.
And we're out of here.
Hi-oh.